Angola was an example of one of the worst, if not the worst, prison in the country. They don't care, really, who carried out the killing. They want someone to pay, and the authorities want Woodfox and Wallace to pay because they were the leading organizers to change those brutal conditions.
America during the 1960s and 70s was torn apart by segregation, racism, sexism, the Vietnam War, and poverty. Individuals like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, and Ella Baker rose to meet the difficult challenges presented to them by history. And then there were the other freedom fighters, uncelebrated and unsung, who were resisting the most oppressive conditions in America's prisons. Prisoners across the country were organizing, and while having some limited successes, they paid a very heavy price, some paying with their lives, as in the Attica massacre ordered by then-New York Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller. The revolutionary attitude was to use any means necessary, whether filing civil suits in state or federal courts, going on work stoppages or hunger strikes, or taking guards hostage. Two such revolutionaries are Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace, who would become known as the Angola Two. Freedom Behind Bars is their story.
Young man lands in jail for some crime he did not commit. 352 years hard labor in Angola prison. 352 years in hard labor. Sleepless nights between sugar cane and cotton. It's where he learns the ropes. Pays with his soul for some crime he did not commit.
Angola Prison is situated on the Mississippi River in southeastern Louisiana and covers more than 18,000 acres of farmland. The state penitentiary is made up of several former plantations whose antebellum slaves had come from the African country of Angola. Angola is considered one of the worst prisons in the country. Richard Becker is an organizer with the International Action Center and on the Angola 2 Defense Committee.
There were widespread killings, torture, the systematic rape and enslavement of young prisoners who were brought in to the yard, and all kinds of abuses which translated into not only power but profit.
Serving terms for armed robbery, Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace began working together shortly after arriving at Angola in 1971. They immediately started organizing, eventually establishing the first chartered chapter of the Black Panther Party behind bars. Woodfox first encountered the Black Panther Party when he was 22 in Harlem. Woodfox was in New York after having escaped from the Orleans Parish prison in 1969. Within days, he was picked up and placed in the Manhattan Detention Center, known as the Tombs. There, he encountered Black Panther Party members. Identified as a militant as a result of his association with the Black Panthers in New York, after his extradition back to the Orleans Parish prison, he was placed on a tier with 12 Black Panthers who were on trial for their alleged involvement in a police shootout. At one of their daily political education classes, Wood Fox and the Panthers decided to take an action against the deplorable conditions in the jail. It was the summer of 1971. After the success of the Panthers' direct action, Wood Fox became an official member of the organization. Shortly thereafter, he was sent to Angola, where some 4,000 mostly African-American inmates were incarcerated.
Can't stop running water, can't kill the fire that burns inside. Don't deny our flesh and blood. Don't forsake our sons and daughters.
Wood Fox says the prison administration used racial divisiveness to control the inmate population. Choice positions such as clerical, supervisory, and medical jobs went to white inmates, while for the most part, black prisoners slaved outside in the fields of the former plantations. Wood Fox says his and Wallace's pledge to the Black Panther Party led them to their initial campaign was to stop prison rapes. Thank you. On April 17, 1972, a white security guard, Brent Miller, was found dead in a black dorm, stabbed 32 times. Authorities say Miller was killed between 7:25 and 7:45 in the morning while most prisoners were at breakfast. His body was found in a corridor of the Pine One dormitory. Within 2 hours of finding Miller's body, authorities stripped Woodfox and marched him to a small, dank, dark cell known as the Hole under armed guard. Wallace, other activist inmates, and later Woodfox were placed in Closed Cell Restricted, or CCR. 2 days after the murder, Hezekiah Brown, a convicted rapist serving a life sentence, testified he saw Woodfox, Wallace, and another inmate, Chester Jackson, commit the murder. Within days, Brown also fingered Gilbert Montague as another murderer. However, Brown's testimony would soon prove to be itself suspect.
There was never any testimony from anybody that there would have been blood all over everybody around and all over the walls and the mattresses and all of this.
Assistant Attorney General Julie Cullen, who prosecuted Woodfox the second time.
There was a lot of contact, close contact, the way the eyewitnesses described it anyway. It wasn't like somebody was far away from them. The perpetrators were right up on top of Brent Miller. And, I mean, how did they get by without having any blood on their clothes? I don't know.
There was one bloody print at the scene of the killing, which did not match any of the four accused. Herman Wallace says prison records show he was already at his workstation around the time of the killing, and that there was no possible way that he could leave the scene of the crime and be at his job without being seen and searched by security guards at various checkpoint gates. Because they had no other evidence, Louisiana prosecutor's case hinged on Brown's testimony. The state said the motive was racial hatred. Woodfox and Wallace say they were framed because their political activism threatened authorities. But they didn't stand a chance against the awesome power of the state. Their state-appointed attorneys proved to be ineffective. Their defense committee had been infiltrated by the FBI, and co-defendant Chester Jackson, nicknamed Noxzema, turned state's evidence against Herman Wallace. Despite evidence to the contrary, Woodfox and Wallace were convicted of Brent Miller's murder in 1973 and 74, respectively. Gilbert Montague was exonerated because prison records and eyewitness accounts from security personnel placed him in the hospital at the time of the murder. Sentenced to life in prison, Woodfox and Wallace continued to be held in the infamous CCR unit of Angola, where they were locked down for 23 hours a day. Nevertheless, their political activism continued unabated. Over the years, they helped hundreds of other inmates with counseling and legal work. Underlying all of their actions was the desire to create more humane conditions for prisoners. They fought against the brutality of guards, unnecessary strip searches, and they went on a 45-day hunger strike to protest the prison's degrading and unsanitary practice of serving meals to CCR inmates on the floor. They also won the right for contact visits. During the 2 decades following their murder convictions, Woodfox and Wallace obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act that substantiated their claim they had been framed. Richard Becker with the International Action Center and the Angola 2 Defense Committee.
Hezekiah Brown testified that he had seen Albert Woodfox kill the guard who was killed, Brent Miller, and said he was the only eyewitness at the time, and testified under oath that he had not received any inducements or any promises from the prison officials or the state attorney general's office in exchange for this testimony. And we now have the documentary evidence in the form of letters that were written by the warden, Murray Henderson, who was the warden at the time, and subsequent wardens and other state officials recommending that Hezekiah Brown be given parole, that Hezekiah Brown be given a carton of cigarettes a week, that he be given other privileges and favors. But most important and most surprising would be that many state officials, high-ranking officials in the law enforcement administration of the state of Louisiana, would join together to seek parole, an early parole for Hezekiah Brown. He had been sentenced to death in the 1960s, and then that was commuted to life without the possibility of parole based on his either fourth or fifth aggravated rape conviction. It would be highly unusual for high-level law enforcement officials to all be joining together on a case like this within 2 or 3 years after a person had begun serving their sentence. I mean, to say that's unusual is an extreme understatement. So clearly what has come out in the years following the trial was that promises were made to Brown and that, in fact, his testimony was bought testimony. And this was the critical testimony in convicting Woodfox in that first trial.
Woodfox was granted a second trial through the efforts of Angola inmate and former Black Panther Robert King Wilkerson. But reopening the case meant a new grand jury would weigh the evidence and decide whether or not to reindict Woodfox. One of the new jurors was Ann Butler, ex-wife of former Angola warden Murray Henderson. Some believe that alone should have been enough to keep her off the grand jury, but on top of that, she had written a book called Dying to Tell about Angola prison. The book contains a chapter about the Miller killing that includes a number of false statements, including that Woodfox had been convicted of rape. Nick Trentacosta, a lawyer for the Loyola Death Penalty Resource Center, says her presence on the grand jury tainted it. The trial began December 7, 1998, in Emmett, Louisiana, the small town where guard Brent Miller is buried, and it lasted 10 days. After deliberating for only 5.5 hours, the jury convicted Albert Woodfox for the second time. Pamela Mabel is Woodfox's sister-in-law.
The judge tells you that if you have a reasonable doubt, you cannot vote that person guilty. You cannot do it. They had too many reasonable doubts.
And that trial was a farce. That trial was a travesty of justice.
Richard Becker.
People were allowed to testify, giving completely, or the prosecution was allowed, in fact, to introduce into evidence, and the judge allowed this to happen, testimony that was completely hearsay testimony. For instance, there was a man on the stand who the prosecution was attempting to say had written a statement way back then in 1973, 10 months after the incident where the guard was killed, saying the prosecution said that he had made a statement describing the killing of the guard. He denied that he had ever made that statement. The statement only existed in the handwriting of a guard. It was not signed. It was not dated. The guard who was still alive and who had supposedly taken down the statement can't really remember it, according to what he said on the stand. And yet the jury was allowed to hear this. And the jury was allowed to hear other things that were not eyewitness testimony, but were in fact hearsay or unrelated information about the political beliefs, for instance, of Albert Woodfox, that created a completely prejudicial atmosphere in that courtroom. And I think that the lead attorney for Albert Woodfox, he had two court-appointed attorneys, has himself said in a petition to the court that his counsel was ineffective. So you had a high-powered prosecution. There were always at least six members of the state attorney general's office in the courtroom. There was a judge who was allowing hearsay, highly prejudicial hearsay testimony to be heard by the jury, and an ineffective defense for Albert Woodfox. And I think the combination of those factors and the fact that the courtroom was packed on the last day with guards and uniforms created a situation where it was pretty predictable that the jury was going to go along with what the state wanted, and that's what they did, and they found Albert Woodfox guilty again.
Prosecutor Collins says that what Becker calls prejudicial testimony, she calls evidence that might indicate a motive for the killing of Guard Miller.
In one letter that was written, he was talking about the requirement for bloodshed and the racist, fascist pigs, and basically talking about some sort of revolution. In another letter, he was talking about killing the white pigs, white fascist pigs. In one of the statements when he was in court in an unrelated hearing, he was raising his hands. His hands were shackled at the time because of problems that he had caused in the courtroom and on an earlier occasion, and he had raised his hands and was turning around facing the prospective jurors, shaking the handcuffs at him, saying basically, look at what the white man's justice has done to me now. This was prior to him even going to Angola in 1971.
As for the defense's charge that it was the witness, Hezekiah Brown, who had the motive, to lie because of all the perks he got. Ultimately, he went from life without parole to freedom. Prosecutor Cullen says his benefits were irrelevant.
I don't think there's anything that I have found or that the defense found or that anyone has presented to me to show me that what benefits Hezekiah got. And I'm not arguing that he didn't get any benefits. He obviously did. I'm not arguing that. My position is that it was after the fact, and based on all of the evidence and the deal, if you want to call it a deal, that he got, there's nothing in there that causes me any concern about his credibility. If somebody does a favor for you, you are going to try to help them. I mean, there's not a prosecutor that's been working longer than maybe 2 months that is not going to have been involved in a situation where if you need information from somebody, you're going to have to make a deal with them.
One of the jurors, Nita Gorell, says ultimately it was Brown's testimony that convinced the jury Woodfox was guilty. Gorell says that when Woodfox testified he passed a lie detector test proving he didn't kill the guard, he went too far. Woodfox's lawyer, Burt Garraway, believes he will be granted yet another trial. Meanwhile, if Herman Wallace hadn't been convicted for Brent Miller's murder, he would have been released from prison in 1992. Several years ago, he filed for post-conviction relief. Wallace is still waiting for the court to set an evidentiary hearing date so that he can establish his claim that his grand jury indictment was unconstitutional. Albert Woodfox will be sentenced on Tuesday, February 23rd. It is fully expected that he will get life without parole. He also expects to be returned to solitary confinement at Angola Prison, where he has resided for the last quarter of a century. Pamela Mabel, Albert Woodfox's sister-in-law.
I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know the change gonna come.
Freedom Behind Bars was produced by Leslie George, written and edited with Dred Scott Keys. With thanks to Pamela and Michael Mabel, Opal Joyner, Walimu Wahaki, Victoria Wallace, Malik Rahim, Scott Fleming, Bryce White, Anita Yesho, and WBAI in New York. Freedom Behind Bars was engineered and mixed by Dred Scott Keys. I'm Leslie George.
Down on my knees. Oh, there's been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. But now I think I'm able to carry on. Oh, it's been a long. Long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Yes, it will.